And hello, you're listening to Tales of Entomology on CGLO 1690 AM. This is a show about insects and history. I'm Lucy, I'm a medieval historian.
And I'm Martin, I'm a biologist. We continue our exploration of the joint history of humans and insects with a show about the silkworm and the history of silk trade. So, as a random entomologist once said, silk is called the queen of textiles due to its glittering luster, softness, elegance, durability, and tensile properties.
This summarizes the reason why people have been fussing over silk for 4,000 to 10,000 years. But before we start exploring myths and legends about the origins of silk weaving, and before we commence our travel on the silk roads, Martin has a little message to pass.
Right. And I don't know if this is an issue for many of you, but who knows? The silkworm, I'm sorry to teach you, is not a worm.
What?
Right? They just call it that because it's worm-like. It's actually a caterpillar, and its adult form is a moth, aptly called the silk moth. They are therefore insects, and which makes sense because this is a show about insects, and as a reminder, this means that the adults possess 6 articulated legs, bodies divided into 3 distinct sections with distinct functions, compound eyes, an exoskeleton, and 2 antennae.
They are part of the order Lepidoptera. The name comes from the ancient Greek lepis, meaning scales, and ptera, meaning wing, so they are scaly wings. The genus is called Bombyx, coming from the ancient Greek word for silkworm, bombyx. Chinese traditions and legends contend that the process of making silk was invented by the legendary Lei Tzu, or Shi Ling Shi, wife of the mythological and semi-god Yellow Emperor, some 2,600 years before the Common Era. One day, tells the legend, a silkworm's cocoon fell in Lei Tzu's tea and started unraveling. The empress thus realized that the cocoon was made from a very long thread that could stretch across her entire garden. She demanded that white mulberry trees be planted to feed the silkworms.
And as Linnaeus named them many thousand years later, Bombyx mori, the silkworm feeds on the leaves of Morus alba. So Bombyx mori, Morus alba, which is the white mulberry tree. Silk moths have a preference for white mulberry leaves, essentially because they like the smell, though they don't have to eat exclusively that. They can also feed off other species of mulberry, red or black, and some other trees as well. The mulberry tree is a fast-growing tree. It usually grows up to 10 to 20 meters. It is generally short-lived with a lifespan comparable to that of humans, and the species is native to northern China.
Besides its role in sericulture, which is raising silkworms, the mulberry tree is notable for the release of its pollen at a very high velocity, 560 kilometers per hour, which is over half the speed of sound. It is the fastest known movement in the plant kingdom. And it kind of looks like little puffs of smoke spouting out from the flowers.
You can find it on YouTube. It's not spectacular, but hey,
it's cute.
It's cute. The mulberry tree yields edible berries, which are shaped like blackberries, ranging from pink to black. They are eaten ripe or dried or made into wine. What the silk moth eats are the leaves of the tree that can be up to 30 centimeters long, though they grow shorter in older trees.
Not that the leaves are prepared as tea in Korea, and I'm actually really wondering what it tastes like. Today, the cultivation of mulberry for silkworms occupies approximately 6,000 square kilometers in China, which is enormous.
So back to the legend of Lei Tzu. She's also credited with inventing the silk reel, which joins fibers of silk into a thread strong enough for weaving. And Lei Tzu is also attributed with the invention of the silk loom that combines silk threads into cloth. Lei Tzu and her husband, the Yellow Emperor, were legendary characters. And as all myths, they were kind of a transmittable roadmap to how you do something, which is a has been a fundamental part of China, where it originated many thousands of years ago.
Yes, until recently, researchers believed that man-made silk dated from 50,000 years ago. But the oldest evidence of man-made silk was very recently discovered in three tombs in Jiahu in the Henan province in central China. And what they found actually was degraded silk proteins dating back some 8,500 years ago, meaning that silk was woven since the year 6,500 before the Common Era, which dates actually from the Neolithic Age. Next question is really, how does the silkworm, who is not a worm, produce its silk that humans weave into fabric since 8,500 years ago?
So first, let's specify that what we're talking about are domestic silkworms. Scientists have identified seven other species of wild silk moths of the same genus, so Bomyx, each found in different areas of Southeast Asia, from Pakistan to Japan and northern China to Vietnam. The domesticated silk moth is its own species, though obviously it wasn't like that originally. We don't actually know when humans domesticated them, since the earliest traces of silk woven by humans date back to nearly 5,000 years before the earliest written records in China.
However, scientists are fairly sure that the domesticated silkworm originated from either the wild silk moth, Bombyx mandarina, so from China, or from another earlier species that was closely related. In terms of their life cycle, silkworms' eggs take about 14 days to hatch into larvae, which eat continuously. So if you decide to breed them, you have to understand that you need to throw mulberry leaves at them at least two or three times a day. So they also shed their skin three times while growing. Each stage is called an instar. So first instar caterpillars are black. Second and third, they are grayish white with black heads. Fifth and final have a white head. In between each instar is a time of resting and molting, which the Japanese call sleeping.
Right. And then they enter the pupal phase of their life cycle, when they enclose themselves in a cocoon made up of raw silk produced by their salivary gland, so their spit. The cocoons are where we get the silk threads. To emerge as adults, they actually pee out enzymes which destroy a portion of the silk. So to avoid destroying the silk, the cocoon is typically boiled, which kills the insect and also makes the silk easier to unravel. This is where the tea episode in the legend of Lei Tzu comes from.
So back to this legend. So this myth actually connected to two important features of ancient Chinese silk culture. The myth didn't develop out of the blue. So first, weaving in general and silk weaving in particular were considered to be feminine tasks. Women only were allowed to process and weave silk up to the 18th century. Second, in ancient China, the empress was really strongly associated to silk production. From the 12th and 11th century before the Common Era, sources testify to religious sericultural ceremonies performed by the empress and her ladies at the beginning of the silk season in the spring.
A third century before Common Era manuscript called Old Ceremonies of the Han describes the ceremony of the beginning of the silk season. When in spring the mulberry trees prosper, the empress attends the plucking of the mulberry leaves. In the garden, there is the house for the silkworms to rear them on hurdles without number. As a sacrifice, a middle sacrifice, consisting of a sheep and a pig, is performed. Nowadays, the silkworm goddesses are named Lady Yuan Yu and Princess Yu. It's only in the 6th century of the Common Era that Xing Li Shi, Lei Tzu, actually became the goddess of sericulture.
But religious ceremonies to a sericulture, a god, gradually disappeared from the 12th century onwards. So sericulture developed in China a very long time ago. It started to be manufactured and retailed in the second millennium before the Common Era, but was largely reserved to the elite. China also started to sell its silk to foreign trade partners, evidence of which dates from the Iron Age.
Silk production and exports increased from the 8th century before the Common Era onwards, when a Persian empire expanded and controlled a vast area going from India to Egypt, up to Turkey and some Greek cities. This vast empire and its successors became the main interface between Asia and the Mediterranean. This is why in the 6th century before Common Era, Chinese silk was found in the burial site of an elite German warrior in Germany. The scale of exchanges was, however, still limited. The Silk Roads were not open for business just yet. It was just the early stages of their development.
So the Chinese imperial power expanded in the 2nd century before the Common Era during the Han period and started annexing Western provinces and sending envoys and embassies to Central Asia to secure safe trade routes and facilitate intercontinental trade.
By the 1st century of the Common Era, the Chinese government had fully succeeded in establishing Silk Roads. China controlled a long corridor stretching from central China westwards and up north to Siberia. Maritime Silk Roads connected China to Southeast Asia, to India, Sri Lanka, and across the Indian Ocean towards the Middle East. India was especially important as a customer and a reseller of raw silk. India then reshipped it, either raw or woven, to the Middle East.
A number of kingdoms and empires had agreed to commercial and peace treaties with China, enhancing the volume of exchange. Among them was the Roman Empire, which ruled most of the Western Europe and of the Middle East. So from the 1st century, the silk trade was blossoming. But China exerted a strict monopoly on sericulture, meaning that China only was where silkworms were cattled and where silk was produced.
Like we said earlier, the domestic silkworm is a species of its own, meaning it's related to the wild silkworm. They don't actually reproduce in nature, though we can hybridize them, which some breeders do to create subspecies with different qualities of silk. Modern silk moths were bred to have white silk instead of the amber-colored silk of their wild ancestors. They have large, fat bodies and tiny wings, so they can't fly. And some might have the ability to lift off and stay airborne a little bit, but they can't actually sustain flight. This makes them easier to raise.
But if you were to release a domesticated silk moth into the wild, it would not be able to survive or to reproduce. Today, humans are the main predators of the silk moth and the silkworm. Because you can buy and eat boiled silkworms like in China, India, Korea, Japan, Thailand, and Vietnam.
So back to history. By the 3rd and 4th century of the Common Era, China exported a lot of raw silk. It was woven in India, in the greater Iran region, and in the Eastern Roman Empire, Greece, and Turkey. The Persian weaving technique wasn't as refined as Chinese weaving expertise, but they came a good second, and they did intricate shapes and patterns on the silk that were very much sought after. So Chinese and Persian silks were thus very expensive products.
In the Eastern Roman future Byzantine Empire, the imperial power had a monopoly on silk weaving from the 3rd century onwards, meaning that silk was only woven at the imperial palace and at imperial workshops, and weaving was done by Christian women only. But in the imperial workshops, silk weaving was done poorly for reasons we don't have time to explain. But the Roman silk was coarser and less lustrous, so less expensive and much cheaper. So the Roman elite kept importing the best products from China and from Persia.
And then it was disaster for China. In the 4th century, silkworms and silk eggs were smuggled to Japan and sericulture developed on the island. Shortly afterwards, sericulture started in India as well. A century later, Syria was starting to cattle their own silkworms, and in the 6th century, Byzantine Emperor Justinian began developing the practice himself. You might actually remember Emperor Justinian from last episode, whose Roman Empire, was beset by the first recorded plague pandemic. The silk trade may have actually facilitated the spread of that first plague. Two competing legends tell the story of how sericulture began in the Eastern Mediterranean.
So the first is that monks from Central Asia offered to bring silkworm eggs to Justinian. They left and they returned to Byzantium 2 years later with the precious cargo. The second story is actually quite similar. Persian Christian monks traveled to the country of the Ceres, which is the ancient name of China, with Ceres meaning silk. And they returned to Byzantium with silkworm eggs hidden in a hollow walking stick. So these stories of industrial espionage are very charming, but they are certainly untrue, because silkworm eggs would not have survived such a long trip.
But historians are pretty sure that sericulture had developed slowly in Byzantine Syria sometime in the 5th century. What Justinian did was finance the planting of large mulberry orchards and support the extension of sericulture into the Byzantine Empire. All this shows that mulberry trees and silkworms are adaptable to many climates. The domestication of silkworms led them, however, to be far less resistant to temperature and humidity fluctuations. Their windows for normal growth are 20 to 28 degrees Celsius, and the optimal yield of silk is 23 to 28 degrees Celsius. Higher than that, and their health is affected, lower, and their physiological activity is retarded, leading to weaker worms. They are essentially relegated to the artificial environments that humans create for them, and silk production really depends on where we can grow mulberry trees.
Which happens to be a very easy thing to do. The mulberry tree is very adaptable. As we shall see, it grew and was successfully imported from the Indian subcontinent to southern Europe. So today, the species is extensively planted throughout the warm temperate world, in the United States, in Mexico, in Australia, in Kyrgyzstan, in Argentina, in Turkey, in Iran. You can find it everywhere, on roadsides, in tree lots, in urban areas, in much of North America.
In the 7th century, a lot of things happened in the Middle East. A new religion was born, Islam, and its followers rapidly structured and conquered a gigantic empire spreading from the Indus River to Spain and Portugal. The empire comprised all the silk-producing areas of Byzantium and the land trade routes from the east they took from the Persians. Besides what was left of Byzantium, the Islamic Empire more or less controlled the silk trade routes outside of China.
So silk industry in Muslim lands exploded and expanded at a very rapid pace, mainly because the central power only exercised a light control on sericulture and opened the industry to all people. From Syria, sericulture spread northward into the mountains of Lebanon, which became another important region for silk production. Syria and Lebanon were soon able to produce enough silk to export the raw material in weaving centers established in Central Asia and in the greater Iran region.
Mulberry trees were also planted in Susa and Nishapur, northern Iran, as well as in Baghdad, Iraq. In Egypt as well, sericulture took off under Muslim rule and spread to North Africa. So silk became a hot commodity in the Islamic Empire, meaning that the Middle East and Europe no longer strictly relied on Chinese silk to weave the precious fabric. The volume of exchanges between China and the West lowered, but China continued to export important volumes of silk, both in the West and in Southeast Asia.
The silkworm was finally introduced to Al-Andalus, which is Portugal and Spain under Islamic rule, in the 9th or 10th century, with great success. Sericulture was also imported to Sicily a little bit later, and earlier on, the Byzantines had established sericulture in Greek islands and in the Balkans. So sericulture and silk production had taken hold across the Mediterranean. And 2 centuries later, silkworm farming spread in other areas of Europe, such as inland Italy, southern France. Italy was the main producer of silk in Europe for centuries. By the 14th century, thus, most European countries possessed their own weaving center, although they relied on imported silk.
Farther south on in North America, in the North American continent. Thank you, Lucy. However, the temperatures were much more amenable. Sericulture arrived in the Americas with the British colonization of the U.S. East Coast.
So the first shipment made the travel in 1613 and arrived in Virginia. By the 18th century, sericulture had spread to Connecticut, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia, the latter being the state producing the best quality silk. But silk production dwindled in the 18th and 19th century because of cotton and tobacco, which became more lucrative. And a blight devastated mulberry orchards in 1844, which definitely killed silk production in the States.
In Europe, diseases affected both mulberry trees and silkworms, and this was happening about at the same time. Louis Pasteur, the famous guy who discovered microorganisms, was even called in to find a solution. But bourgeois fashion at this time began to move on, and silk wasn't really that popular. There was also the invention of artificial silk in 1884 that did a pretty good number on silk production. At the same period, Japan took up the main production in the world until World War II. Being among the bad guys of the war, they were then cut off from most markets. This forced the rest of the world to find substitutes such as nylon for things like parachutes and stockings. China took up the slack in the 90s with its more capitalist economic reforms, and they are to this day the main producer of silk, seconded by India.
In collective representations, China is associated with silk production, and for good reasons. For thousands and thousands of years, China was the sole provider of silk to the world. Even if China lost for a couple of centuries its leading role in sericulture, it has now regained the rank of first producer of silk worldwide.
And maybe even beyond. On January 2nd, 2019, so not even a year ago, China opened a new Silk Road. You might have heard about it. The Chinese Chang'e 4 lander took silkworms to the moon. A small tin in the lander contained potato seeds and silk moth eggs. The plants would support the silkworms with oxygen, and the silkworms would provide the plants with necessary carbon dioxide and nutrients through their waste. The reason why researchers have sent potatoes and silkworms to the moon is not to start a potato silk business. They want to evaluate whether plants perform photosynthesis and grow and bloom in the lunar environment.
So this is all we had for today. We hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much for listening. And next week, there won't be a new Tales of Entomology. We will do a rerun of the first show because I'm away. But we'll be back with a fresh new episode 2 weeks from now, which is about the dreaded mosquito. So you're listening to CGLO and 1690 AM. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.